very much. All right. We're going to go on to case number two, which is 113320, United States versus Ritz.
This is Ritz.
Not a problem. I'm whispering today. Mr. Menninger.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Michael Menninger. I am here on behalf of Ronald Ritz, who is the defendant and the appellant in this matter. As the court, I'm sure, has gleaned from the briefing and from the record, this case is a bit of a procedural, I guess we could call it a nightmare. And there certainly are legal and procedural issues that are at stake on this appeal.
Well, let me ask you before you get it. Now, you didn't raise any real argument below suggesting that the spigots don't count as service connections, and you didn't raise the specific statute of limitations issue or the notice hearing argument either for your particular client. So why shouldn't we find this whole appeal is waived? I understand the brother made those arguments, but not your client. He didn't adopt the brief.
Your point is well taken, Your Honor. In fact, I didn't represent Mr. Ritz at the lower court level.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, Mr. Ritz did, in fact, in his motion for summary judgment, or I think as it was couched, a motion for judgment on the pleadings, did raise the issue as to what the definition of service connection is or whether the campground does constitute a public water system under that definition.
That was after summary judgment was granted against Ronald Ritz, right?
Well, I believe
isn't that when all this stuff was raised?
Well, it might have been raised more specifically by Thomas Ritz in his particular pleadings, but I do know that Ronald Ritz, and sorry for the confusion on the brothers and all that, but that Mr. Ritz did raise the particular issue that the campground did not constitute a public water system under the definition, under either prong of the definition of a public water system, because it didn't have the service connections or didn't.
But you're going to have to help us,
right? Okay.
Because you're going to have to identify the point in the summary judgment briefing in the district court in which Ronald Ritz, as opposed to Thomas Ritz, raised the arguments that the spigots didn't constitute service connections, that the settlement agreement was enforceable, or that the judgment as a matter of law was appropriate because no administrative hearing was provided. Where is all of that?
Judge, I don't have the specific docket entry at hand, but I do know that this issue was raised by Ronald Ritz in his motion for judgment on the pleadings, which was initially very early on. I believe it might have been document number 58. And I apologize for not having that at hand, Your Honor.
That's our problem here.
Because it's not good enough if it's after the court has already ruled that he raises it.
Well, I understand that, Judge. And in fact, I would like to turn the court's attention to the decision in the Datsun Sales case versus Nissan Motor Corporation, in which this court held that there are some exceptions to whether issues can be raised for the first time on appeal. I think the primary issue in this case, or at least the threshold issue, is the notice or the statute of limitations issue. Where jurisdiction is at stake or in exceptional circumstances, this court may hear issues for the first time on appeal.
What would the exceptional circumstance be here?
Well, again, as to jurisdiction, or in fact whether the court has the ability to hear this case at all, under the Safe Drinking Water Act, the administrator was required to give notice of any failure to comply with the requirements of the Safe Drinking Water Act. There's nothing in the record that demonstrates that fact. and the notice was to be provided to this public water system and also to the state, and no such notice took place. So if an administrative hearing, if Mr. Ritz was not even entitled to an administrative hearing, he certainly was required to notice under paragraph A, under 300G of the 300G3 of the Safe Drinking Water Act. And only after that notice is a civil suit authorized under paragraph B of that same section. Now, this 1998 administrative...
So, but now, this document number 58, you say that he filed. I mean, he did have some... If you're relying on this document 58 in the record, then he did have some notice of what was going on. So why should this be an exceptional type circumstance?
Well, he had notice because he was sued in 2007. And I think sort of the procedural issue, and what I'd like to get the court back to, is that we have an administrative order that was issued in 1998. It was served on the wrong party. It was served without any prior notice, as required under paragraph A of 300G3. And, in fact, well, it referenced the usage prong of the definition of a public water system and not, in fact, the service connection prong, which is ultimately what was dispositive in this case. Moreover, the terms of the administrative order, they expired on its own as of January 31st, 2000, and the complaint seeking civil penalties was not filed until 2007. So as to whether the district court could even hear this case is certainly a threshold issue and is one of the narrow exceptions contemplated by the Datsun case. Now, with respect to the statute of limitations, specifically, now, Mr. Ritz does concede that the EPA can bring an action for injunctive relief without regard to a statute of limitations. There's no issue there. But the fact that there was a lack of notice, I guess we have to look at the 1998 administrative order. Now, there is a five-year statute that requires actions be brought within that time where civil penalties are sought. Now, this cause of action necessarily had to accrue sometime prior to the 1998 administrative order. Again, an order that was never served on Mr. Ritz, was served without the requisite notice beforehand.
The requirement of testing was an ongoing obligation and was repeatedly violated during the relevant time period. And the civil penalty that was sought only related to violations within that five-year period of time.
I agree with that, Judge.
Yeah.
But the fact is, in order for a civil suit to be brought under paragraph B, under 300G3 of the Safe Drinking Water Act, the administrator, and I quote the statute, shall give notice to the state and to the public water system. And no such notice was afforded in this case. Mr. Ritz may or may not have been violating the letter of the statute. Certainly whether it applies to him is at issue. But more importantly, he never received actual notice of any alleged violations, never received the opportunity or the assistance, as the statute requires, of the EPA to assist the state or to assist the public water system to bring the campground into conformity with the statute. So I think we have really a threshold issue of whether the district court could have even heard this case. Could have even heard this case in the first place. And I think that that is all part of the procedural issues. Certainly another very important issue, which I think gives rise to the narrow exception, is the existence of this settlement agreement. Now, the troubling part of the settlement agreement, I think, for Mr. Ritz, is that we started off dealing with this issue, in fact, by motion filed by the EPA.
Now, here's our problem with all of that. That argument certainly appears to have been first raised in his opposition to summary judgment, which occurred after summary judgment had already been entered against Ronald Ritz. So,
respectfully, Judge, the issue was first raised by the EPA itself, and I think that's where this exceptional circumstance comes into play and where I think the district court seriously erred. I don't typically like to read in these situations, but I haven't memorized this particular portion, but this language is directly from the EPA filed in its motion to enforce a settlement agreement, which is document number 98. An agreement to settle claims in federal court is enforceable just like any other contract. In fact, the judicial policy of Indiana strongly favors settlement agreements. Now, these citations to law are to decisions of this court and to district court decisions that were then cited by this court. The EPA continues that although settlement agreements differ from court-ordered judgments, Such agreements are nonetheless binding on the parties, and if the contract is unambiguous, the parties' intent should be determined solely from the contract.
But, of course, here the settlement agreement could never be enforced because it was dependent on the parties reaching a consent decree, and that never happened. And the parties recognize as much because, you know, they filed that joint notice to the court, informing the court that they've been unable to resolve the issues related to the consent decree. I don't know.
I understand your question, Judge. At least I think I understand your question, and I'd like to respond in a couple of ways. Well, it's an interesting situation, and of course, Mr. Ritz might, if he were here, might tell you that he wasn't a part of that agreement to let the motions be reopened, but that's never mind. That's neither here nor there for purposes of this. But when the district court overruled the EPA's motion to enforce the settlement agreement, it did not state that the settlement agreement was, in fact, unenforceable. It stated that it was unenforceable based on the proposed consent decree provided by the EPA. That proposed consent decree consisted of 34 pages of additional terms that did not relate to the third-party testing of the nitrate and total coliform as contemplated by the settlement agreement. For example, there were stipulated penalties. The government was trying to reserve unlimited access to the campground. Dispute resolutions under the consent decree, these were all extraneous terms that were not contemplated by the parties. Now, an agreement to agree, as the trial court noted, is unenforceable. That was citing the Woolvos v. Meyer case, which was then cited by this court in Mays v. Trump. But that's actually not a complete recitation of that rule. There's one word that I think is a critical word there, and that is the word mere agreement to agree. In this court stated in Mays v. Trump that under Indiana law and under the law of any jurisdiction, a binding contract is formed where there is a meeting of the minds on the essential terms. Here, the essential terms of this settlement agreement were a consent decree for third-party testing of the nitrate and the total coliform. There was a liquidated sum to be paid by, at that time, the Brothers Ritz, and then no admission of liability of the Brothers Ritz under the Safe Drinking Water Act. So to the extent that there is an agreement to agree, that may be one provision, and under Indiana contract law, illegal or unenforceable provisions may be severed. And I would offer to this court that the effect of that particular portion of the settlement agreement could not affect the symmetry of the contract as a whole. It could not.
Well, my problem is, you know, that the agreement was premised upon an execution of a consent decree that was never executed. No part of it is enforceable.
Well, to get to that point, Judge, I see that I'm getting into my rebuttal time, but the purpose of the settlement agreement, in part, was for testing, and I would contend that Mr. Ritz had an obligation with his campground to test whether the consent decree existed or not, and the consent decree was specifically for the mechanics of how the testing was to take place and did not affect the underlying, I guess, reason for that particular part of the agreement, which was that Mr. Ritz test the water at the campground. So even if the provision is not severable, it seems disingenuous that the EPA can sit here and say that the settlement agreement is not enforceable when it once argued so vigorously that it was.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, so it's Ms. Barton. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Catherine Barton from the Justice Department for the United States, and with me at council table is Joanna Glowacki, who's regional counsel for EPA. Just to answer the first question that was raised here about what argument was made in Ronald Ritz's motion for judgment on the pleadings or in the alternative summary judgment, it's on page 4 of document entry 58, and he argues that it hasn't served 25 individuals daily for at least, the campground hasn't served 25 individuals daily for at least 60 days, which is not at issue here. And he says, similarly, the area in question does not currently and has never had at least 15 service connections in use at least 60 days out of the year. His understanding was that he misunderstood the law, that it was required for use for 60 days, and did not dispute whether there were service connections.
So you're saying that he said that, you know, that he had never had a situation that went over 60 days.
Exactly. And actually, you can look on page 40 of our supplemental appendix at page 86 of the deposition of Ronald Witz that we include there. And he actually, there's a question. His affidavit actually says the same thing, that the camp's water system has never had at least 15 service connections in use at least 60 days per year. And the U.S. attorney on the case, assistant U.S. attorney on the case, says, what do you mean by service connection to him? And he says, well, I'm assuming a camper that pulls up and screws their pipes in, you know, hooks up to the water. I'm assuming that's what you're talking about. So in other words, we know there's more than 15 spigots on the property, but there are very few of those that are used, and there's certainly 60 days. I can't think of any that are used 60 days per year. So he basically assumed in a common sense manner, which is very sensible under the statute and the purpose of the statute and the terms, that providing water to a campsite through a service connection where trailers hook up is in fact a service connection under the statute, and never argued contrary until we got to Thomas.
So, and what he's doing now, or has been doing, has been arguing that he was not on notice of this basis for liability, right?
Well, I think he's arguing that, I mean, that the statute provides the basis for liability. It says 15 service connections, and so does the regulation. I guess my sense of his argument about not being on notice relates to the administrative order. And the administrative order, first of all, is just a red herring. The judgment can be sustained. The administrative order didn't give us any relief or any basis for summary judgment that isn't based on the allegations in our complaint and that the district court found just for violations of the statute and the regulations themselves.
Well, tell me this. Was the number of service connections argued as a basis for summary judgment by the government, or was it first raised by the district court?
It was raised by us.
Okay.
Both Ritz brothers filed their motion for summary judgment. Then before we filed our cross motion, we actually did the depositions in which it became clear to us that we were getting a runaround and we couldn't get any documents from them to confirm how much use there was at the campground. They kept, you know, saying, oh, we don't have those records. Oh, there's been a flood. Oh, we try to close it down and turn off the water and things like that. So we decided to go under the 15 service connections since we were in the summary judgment stage.
And so is Ritz correct when he says in his reply brief that the district court never afforded him an opportunity to file a response to the United States motion for summary judgment?
Well, he never asked for it, and he filed a joint notice with the United States saying briefing was completed and the case was ready for decision. That's the notice that he says if Ronald Ritz was here, he would tell you he didn't intend to sign, but his lawyer signed it. There's nothing in the record to that effect, and he didn't try at any time in the district court to say, oh, you should have let us go back. In fact, he raised some issues in the motion to reconsider on the remedy and acknowledged that he couldn't raise them with regard to summary judgment because that had been decided. And remedy isn't challenged here on appeal.
Do you have any case law to support your interpretation of the term service connection?
No. And the reason we don't is this issue does not arise for several reasons. One is that we almost always can get the data on how many people and how much use there is. Another is that almost everybody complies. These are not expensive tests. It's a few hundred dollars. And third, if you're getting your water from a municipality or some source upstream that is already complying, you don't have to comply with the regulations, and that exempts many. So what you end up with here are things like this campground. In fact, when Indiana referred this case to EPA, it referred a number of cases, all the rest of which were resolved without going through any litigation. But this one just after, and you can see this through the declaration of Ray Urchell from EPA and the letters attached to court, the years of correspondence between us and the Ritz family and people at the campground, that we just couldn't get any resolution. We gave them time after time. We sent them things about how to do the testing, gave them lists of labs, and we just couldn't get them to comply. If there's anything else I can say to be helpful to the court seems to have a good understanding of the case.
Thank you.
We ask that the judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Manager, come on up.
Thank you, Your Honors. Briefly, I just want to state that I wish that the record were better. I do. But Mr. Ritz gets the benefit of, and the court certainly has the obligation to review the grant of summary judgment de novo. So if the trial court or the district court erred in its interpretation of what constitutes a service connection, then this court certainly has it within its authority to overrule that. There was just an equation of a spigot and a service connection, and that's all the court did, and that's all the court decided. There was a lengthy discussion of the history and purpose of the Safe Drinking Water Act in the EPA's brief, and I think Mr. Ritz understands the EPA's goal in protecting persons from consuming untested or possibly unsafe water, but just because it is a campground does not mean that it is covered or that the Safe Drinking Water Act covers in general a campground or any other facility in general. It's whether it covers this particular facility. And a leap was made that a spigot or a faucet is in fact a service connection based on what I'm not really sure. But it seems to me that in a situation where there is one or no service connections, as this campground was serviced by a well, Congress certainly had it within its authority to expand the definition of what constitutes a public water system and instead limited it to whether it has 15 service connections, which this campground does not, or whether it serves a minimum or an average of 25 people for a minimum of 60 days out of the year, which, again, this campground does not. So because the campground is not a public water system under the definition of the Safe Drinking Water Act.
When counsel says they tried to get the records, what do the records reflect that were turned over in terms of the number of days?
To be honest, Your Honor, I'm not really sure specifically to what they refer, but I think the EPA made a decision based on the testimony of both Ronald Ritz and of Thomas Ritz that the campground was simply not open more than 60 days out of the year, regardless of the number of people that it serviced, because it was seasonal and weekends. Your Honors, I see that I'm out of time.
Now finish your thought.
Well, I really was just wrapping up, Judge, and I was because it's not the campground is not a public water system, and because Mr. Ritz was not afforded appropriate notice under the Safe Drinking Water Act, the district court should be overruled on those grounds. In the alternative, there is an enforceable settlement agreement. Whether the provision to the consent decree is severable or not, there were essential terms agreed to by the parties, and for that reason, the district court's overruling of the motion to enforce a settlement agreement should be overturned as well. Thank you, Your Honors.
Gosh, thanks to both parties, and the case will be taken under advisement.